I like the story of the little girl who was pestering her dad about marriage. Dad, what does it mean? And so he tried to explain, and he thought he'd done a good job, but she hadn't quite grasped it. So he said, look, sit down. And he pulls out a photograph album. And again, he tries to explain, you know, this is the best man and these are the bridesmaids and this is the church and all these kind of things. Now, do you understand? She said, I think so. She said, at which point did Mummy come to work for us? Well, Peter had gone to work for Jesus. Jesus had called him, follow me. And Peter did what many of us would struggle to do. He left everything. Wife, mother-in-law, well, maybe that weren't so hard. The family home, the family business. All he had worked for all his life, he put it to one side to follow Jesus. The last few weeks for him have been an emotional roller coaster. From the heights of seeing Jesus do miracles to seeing his Lord put on a cross. And then hearing the news and seeing the empty tomb. And then Jesus has gone again. So he's on an emotional roller coaster. And now he's back at the shores of Galilee. He's gone home, gone up north. You realise, of course, that Jesus and the disciples were northerners, don't you? And they came from Galilee. They probably had a regional accent. They no doubt enjoyed the Israeli equivalent of mushy peas and brown sauce. Because there was one southerner, but we best not mention him, Judas. What are they doing in Galilee? Well, they're there for good reason. They haven't just gone home. They're actually going in obedience to what Jesus said. For example, when Peter encountered an angel in Matthew 28, verse 7, the angel said, go back to Galilee. When he encountered Jesus, just three verses later, Matthew 28, 10, Jesus told him to go to Galilee, but wait. And that's the hard bit, isn't it? Wait. And so this is partial obedience. He's gone to the right place, but it's also partial disobedience because he's not waiting. He's not waiting. And I'm going to divide this little passage under four headings. First of all, there is a night of defeat. A night of defeat. That's verses 1 to 3. If you like the Charlie Brown Snoopy type cartoons, there's a great one where Charlie Brown is always complaining about losing games. And Lucy, in an attempt to console Charlie Brown, says, remember Charlie Brown, you learn more from your defeats than from your victories. To which Charlie Brown replies, well, I must be the smartest person in the world. Now, we don't like it, but it's true. We learn more from our defeats often than from our victories. When things go wrong, they give us spiritual backbone that we cannot get when life is smooth. And we're going to pick up the story of Peter, who I think is in a difficult situation. He's going through a difficult time. And this is, for him, a night of defeat. Let me give you four suggestions why. Notice in verse 3 it says this. It was night time. It was night time. It was dark. And I would suggest that's a good picture of Peter's spiritual soul, spiritual state. Throughout John's gospel, whenever John uses that term, it was night, it's in a negative way. You remember Nicodemus in chapter 3 comes to Jesus and we're told it was night. Why? Because Nicodemus, the leader of the Sanhedrin, the spiritual leader of the nation, was in himself in spiritual darkness. So Jesus said, you've got to be born again. You need to come into the light. You're in spiritual darkness. Again, when Judas in chapter 13, 30 went out to betray Jesus, we're told, it was night. Judas walking in darkness and his deeds were evil. And I would suggest here that John, again, being consistent with his gospel, mentions the fact it was night. Because that's Peter's spiritual condition. Everything is dark. Jesus has gone. He doesn't know what to do, where to go. He's just sitting there waiting, waiting. Secondly, of course, he had no direct word from the Lord. He could have been praying, he could have been fasting, he could have been seeking the mind and the heart of God. But instead, he does what so many of us do. He doesn't trust in the Lord, he instead leans on his own understanding. And with impatience, he says to the other guys, "I'm going fishing. Are you coming?" Thirdly, notice that their fishing expedition ends in failure. Verse 3. That night they caught nothing. That night they caught nothing. How frustrated Peter and the disciples must have felt. All night long fishing and not a little tiddler, not a single fish did they catch. And once again, I think this is a great picture of someone who's outside of God's will. Earlier on in John's Gospel, chapter 15, Jesus had said to his disciples, "Without me, you can do nothing." And here they are, striving all night long outside of the will of Jesus. And so what do they accomplish? Nothing. He's acting independent. He should have been waiting. Instead, he's gone fishing. And so fourthly, another indication he's outside the will of God, that when Jesus appears, they don't recognize him. Verse 4. Jesus stood on the shore and they did not realize it was Jesus. Their spiritual sight is blurred, is dimmed. Now, it may be that the Holy Spirit hid the identity of Jesus, like for the two people on the road to Emmaus. But there's no suggestion that's what happened. They did not recognize Jesus. Maybe Peter's spiritual vision is dim. And did you notice that it's not just Peter who's outside of the will of God, but those he took with him, the other disciples, the other six. And someone has said that when we sin, we never sin in a vacuum. It always has a knock-on effect. We always hurt or lead astray other people. And that's the situation at the start of John chapter 21. It is a night of defeat. The next section, verses 4 to 17, I'd like to call a morning of decision. A morning of decision. Story told of a husband, and he married his wife, and they did what most couples did. They said, "Look, how's this marriage going to work?" And basically the husband was saying, "Who wears the trousers? You know, am I going to wear the trousers, or are you going to say, you wear the trousers, but I'll say which pair?" And, you know, they'd like to say it was a partnership, but often one partner is a little bit more dominant than the other. So they came to this agreement. The husband said, "Look, all major decisions in this marriage I will make, and all the smaller, the minor decisions you can make." And they said, "Fine." Well, when they're celebrating 25 years of marriage, someone said, "What's your secret?" And the husband revealed this little story. He said, "When we got married, we made a pact. All the big decisions I would make, all the small decisions my wife would make. Has it worked?" "Yes," said the husband, "in 25 years of marriage, I've never had to make one big decision yet." Now in this chapter, Peter has some important decisions. At first he gets it wrong. Look at verse 4. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul in the net because of the large number of fish. Wow. Not night anymore. The light has come. And Jesus stands on the shore and he calls out, "Friends," it's literally little children. It's a colloquial. It's like us saying to a group of men, "All right, lads, you're right, boys." And in the Greek language, you can ask a question and let people know you already know the answer by the words you use. I suppose it's a bit like us saying to, "You haven't caught anything, have you?" That type of question. And so Jesus asks the question And in the way he asked it, the disciples know that he knows. They haven't caught anything. They can't kid him. And they say, no, no, we haven't caught anything. No doubt there's embarrassment there. And in verse 6, there's a change in attitude and results. Jesus said, cast your net on the right side. And what a difference. All night without Jesus, they struggle and they strive and they catch nothing. A few minutes obeying the command of Jesus. Wow. A net full of fish. And I love verse 11. Large fish. They're whoppers. They're whoppers. They're not sardines or tiddlers. These are whoppers. A few minutes with Jesus in control accomplishes more than a whole night of carnal efforts. It's something we're slow to learn, but we have to relearn it again and again and again. I can't, he can. I love this passage because there's a number of mini miracles. Can you have a mini miracle? It's a bit like saying someone's a little bit pregnant. They're either pregnant or they're not. It's either miraculous or it's not. And in verse 11, Peter's given miraculous strength. In verse 6, they're all trying to pull the net in. They can't do it. But Peter does it. Not only that, you got this barbecue, this fire on the beach. Who made it? Did Jesus do it and then call the lads? Or is that a miracle that it was provided for their needs? Everything in this passage, though, is designed for deja vu. It's to trigger off memories in the mind of Peter so that he moves from darkness to light. So in verse 6, they encounter Jesus afresh after the resurrection with a miracle catch of fish. Deja vu. Think back to Luke chapter 5. How did Peter first encounter Jesus? By a large catch of fish. They couldn't catch anything. He says, throw your net on the other side, and a large catch of fish. In verse 9, Jesus takes them to this fire of burning coals. Deja vu. In chapter 18, just a few days earlier, Peter had been warming himself by a fire, and a little girl said, you're one of his followers, I can tell by your accent. And he denied Jesus. All that happens is meant to trigger off memories. Why did Jesus send them to Galilee? Because Galilee is the place they saw Jesus feed crowds of 5,000. On the Sea of Galilee, they saw Jesus walking on the water. It all brings back memories. So Peter's moving from darkness to light. And then we have a day of dedication, verses 18 and 19, a day of dedication. Fritz Kreisler was an Austrian-born violinist and composer. They say he's one of the greatest violinist masters of all time. On one occasion, after he had done a concert, a woman rushed up to him and said these words, Mr. Kreisler, I'd give my life to play as beautiful as you do. His reply was simple, I did. I did. You want to be as good as me? You know, you practice day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. It is a life calling, a dedication to be that good. He was a man dedicated to his violin. For 3 years, Peter had been dedicated to Jesus. He left everything to follow Jesus. But now at this time of limbo, he's torn between going back to fishing and who knows what's coming next. Will anything else come next? And I like the way Jesus deals with him. Look at verse 13. First of all, he takes care of his practical needs before he meets his spiritual needs. He gives Peter the chance to dry off by the fire, to warm himself. He cooks them food so that they're fed. And they can spend time enjoying the friendship of Jesus. And sometimes we're slow to learn that before we can meet someone's spiritual needs, we have to meet them practically. In the summertime on our summer camp, I always serialized the life of a great man or woman of God. And in the summertime, we serialized for 5 minutes a day the life of William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army. And one of William Booth's principles was this, that a man with a hungry belly doesn't listen to a spiritual message. If you fill their belly, you'll get their attention to preach the gospel. You meet someone's practical needs, you then win them to meet their spiritual needs. And that's what Jesus does here with Peter. Come and dry off. Come and get warm. Come and have some food. Come and enjoy some company. And then when the time is right, let's meet those deeper needs. I like what Warren Wiersbe, the commentator, says. He says there's a vast difference between sonship, being saved, and discipleship, following the Lord. Remember one pupil bumped into a teacher and said, "Oh, hello, miss, fancy seeing you here." And she said, "Yes, I remember you. I was one of your students." And the teacher replied, "You may have attended my classes, but you were not one of my students." There's a difference. You were in the right place, you were in the right building, you had the right books, but you had no desire to learn, no desire to take on board the things I was sharing. The difference between a pupil and a student. The difference between a disciple and a believer. A disciple is committed. They take on board. And Wiersbe said, there's a vast difference between sonship, being saved, and discipleship, following the Lord. Not all Christians are disciples. But when Peter sinned, he did not lose his sonship. He did not fall away, but he did fall away from his discipleship. And so for this reason, Christ repeated his call, "Follow me." In our house, my 17-year-old and my 15-year-old sometimes are a pain in the neck. They're at it all the time, arguing all the time with one another. And you know what it's like. In the end, as parents, you just say, "Stop it." But it was, "Stop it, I don't want to hear another word." And then someone will say, and you say, "That's it, I've had enough. Now go to your room." Now those children have not stopped being my children. They're still my son and my daughter, but they've fallen out. There's a bad atmosphere between me and them. I know it and they know it. And I know in a matter of time, one of them's going to come back and say, "Dad, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it." Now they're always my child, but we need to do that healing to get right what is wrong in that relationship. And that's what happens here. Peter has not lost his sonship. He belongs to Jesus. But something's not right. He denied Jesus 3 times. And now that needs healing. That needs dealing with. And so Jesus is going to show Peter not only is there forgiveness, but he's still got a role for him. He's still got a calling and ministry. Look at verse 15. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." And again he said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt. Because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." 3 times Peter had denied his Lord. And here, 3 times, Jesus gives Peter the opportunity to confess him and his love for the Lord, to put right that which he had committed wrong. It's interesting how Jesus refers to Peter. He doesn't call him Peter. He says, "Simon." He used his old name. "You've gone back to your old ways. Come on, Simon. Remember how I called you and changed you? We're going right back to the beginning." And sometimes when we make mistakes, we need to trace back to where we went wrong. Deal with the issue. If we can't remember the issue, go all the way back and kind of start again. 3 times Jesus says, "Do you love me?" Now, we've got a problem in English because we've got one word, love, and you have to let it go into that brain of yours, your computer, and let your computer put it in context. So if I said I love my parents, you know what I mean. If I said I love my wife, now obviously I love my wife differently to how I love my parents, but you know what I mean. If I say I love fish and chips, you know that I love fish and chips differently to how I love my wife. And if I say I love my football, again, they're all the same word, love, in English, but different context, different types of expressions. In the Greek language, the language of the New Testament, they don't have that problem. They've got at least five words for love, and they're quite specific. And Jesus uses the word agape, unconditional love. He says, Peter, the first time, do you have an unconditional love for me? Peter says, well, I'm very fond of you. He replies with a different word. He uses the word philia, mean that you're like a brother. We're solid. It's a good answer, but it's not the word Jesus used. So a second time Jesus says, do you have an unconditional love for me? And again he says, Lord, philia, oh, we're like brothers. Of course I love you. And the third time Jesus says, well, if you like that word so much, I'll use it. Peter, are we like brothers? Do you have that philia love for me? And Peter says, Lord, you know everything. Look, I love you, but my love is flawed. Earlier on, Peter had boasted, all this lot will forsake you, but not me. Maybe he's being cautious this time and saying, my love's not above everyone else's. It's flawed like theirs. I want to love you, but I'm scared to boast about it because last time I did, I blew it. And three times, Jesus says, don't worry, I've got a job for you. I've got a job for you. And the question's interesting. Do you love me more than these? What did Jesus mean? Did he mean the fish? Peter, that's what you used to do. Your old life. Do you love me more than your old life? Your fishing. Or is he saying, do you love me more than these? The other disciples. You boasted about it. You said, all of them, Lord, they're going to forsake you, but not me. My love's superior to theirs. Maybe he meant both. Who knows? But in the end, he said to Peter, Peter, who's first? Me or these? And Peter says, you. You. He affirms his love for Jesus. Three denials, three responses. And then the fourth bit, I've called it a lifetime to serve. A lifetime to serve. Now you think with all that's going on in Peter's brain, he'd be either saying, thank you, Lord, I'm forgiven. Or he'd be saying, how am I going to feed the lambs? What do you want me to do? You know, am I going to do Bible studies with them? Am I going to have classes with them? Are we getting a Bible school? What are we doing? You think all these questions are racing through his mind. And in verse 20, he says, what about him? Totally distracted by another disciple, John. And you think, Peter, haven't you been listening? Peter turned and saw that disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned against Jesus at the supper and said, Lord, who is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about him? Actually, there's a little section where Jesus says, Peter, when you're old, you're going to die for me. You know, when you're young, you choose what to wear, you choose where to go. But when you're older, someone else is going to do it. And he indicates the way Peter's going to die. And maybe Peter looks at John and says, hold on, I've got the short end of the stick here, haven't I? I'm going to be martyred. What about him? Is he going to be martyred too? You know, have I drawn the wrong lot? And Jesus said, Peter, don't worry about him. Just be concerned about yourself. And I guess there's two short principles as we finish. Number one, each one of us are responsible for our own actions. Twice, Jesus said, what is that to you? And you follow me. We're all responsible for our own actions. It was Franklin P. Jones who once wrote, be thankful for your bad luck. Without it, you'd have to blame yourself. And Jesus says to Peter, don't worry about him. Your priority is what I want for you. I am responsible for my actions. Please don't come up and tell me what I should be doing next week. I'll ask Jesus what I should be doing next week. And I won't come up to you and tell you what you should be doing next week. You ask Jesus what he wants you to do next week. We're all responsible for our own actions. And the final principle is this. We're all responsible for using our God-given talents. Feed my lambs. Feed my sheep. Take care of my people. God has gifted Peter for a specific job. Same as God has gifted you. When you became a Christian, you were given at least one spiritual gift. Maybe three, maybe five, maybe ten. We're not told. You have to discover those gifts and then decide how you're going to use them. And as well as your spiritual gifts, you've got natural talents. Don't make a cemetery of your life by burying your spiritual gifts and talents. They're given to you so that you can serve Jesus. And I'm responsible for my actions and for using my talent. And you're responsible. So don't think about others in that sense. What about, hey, say, Lord, what about me? What can I do for you? Let's pray.